This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello and welcome to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast. I'm Paul, your host. This podcast is all about Porsche and their cars and the people and the technology and the engineering that goes behind it. You'll find your Porsche stories, which is us, me, talking to you about your Porsche, your journeys and your life experiences with those cars. Tech Talk, which is all about the technical aspects of Porsche. Waffle, which is just me whittering on about basically anything with some friends, and Heritage, which looks at the entire journey of Porsche from the earliest days to the present day. If that sounds interesting to you, then stick around. Welcome back to the Rengineering YouTube and podcast, and welcome to episode 29. This week we're back for a Your Porsche Stories episode, and that is coming from New Zealand this time, and a chap called Ross that I did a Zoom call with just before Christmas. They are not in chronological order, so those of you that have contributed to Your Porsche Stories episodes and are like, oh, I shot mine in November, why is it not coming out yet? Well, it's not coming out yet because what I'm trying to do is balance content. So some of the longer episodes will come out at one point, and then some of the short episodes, if we've got an influx of heavy YouTube content coming out, I'll put some of those shorter ones in just to balance it all out. But as I say, this one's with Ross. Ross, it's the what was really interesting about that is the culture in New Zealand and the ability to be able to build resto mods or air-cooled 911s. Isn't as you would experience it in the States or even in the UK. And that's what Ross has. He built himself with support from some suppliers, but you know, a lot of the work was hand cranked for him. An absolutely amazing car. So head over to, you can see the podcast episode and you can watch us chat visually if that's what you want to do. You can see that on YouTube. And there'll be some pictures and some content on the Instagram page as well. That's at Rengineering UK. But before we get into that, as always, there is an update as to what's going on and what I found recently, which I'm just going to take you through. So the first thing I want to do is talk about a little bit more about my car and the fact that the first of the next series of Ren Builds episodes went out a couple of weeks ago. And then there was a gap where Sunday I had planned to drop the next episode, went back through all my content. Bearing in mind, guys, I've got terabytes of content that I'm having to sift through and kind of edit and then put together and then release. And there's been the odd occasion, it hasn't happened very frequently, but the odd occasion where I've gone to get something thinking, I know I've got a load of really nice time lapses I can use, and then went to try and find some of those time lapses, stick some music over the top of it, and annoyingly, even in the intros or the kind of the intermediate bits between the time lapsing where I kind of reference it, I actually start referencing time lapsing. So when I started to try to build that episode, it all fell apart. So that's why there's a gap. It annoyed the hell out of me that there's a gap. Because I've really tried to be consistent since kind of the back end of last year and dropping content regularly. But I kind of balanced, do I just put something together that's lesser than? But I just don't think the content would have been as interesting. So I'd made the decision to kind of sit back a little bit, and I'm going to do something slightly different with that. So that's still coming out, that Ren Builds episode of kind of the next step, covering some of the decals, the exhaust, the diffuser, all those sorts of things that on my particular car now, my Cayman, that's all coming up. But yeah, I had to take a moment to pause on that. One of the interesting things though is that I scour around on different forums and Facebook, but I'm not always that active, mostly because I just don't have time. But one thing that did come up, actually, that I found really interesting and really exciting was that there's a company called Gold Leaf Performance. They have looked at adapting the Cayman GT4 RS side intakes, so the ones that sit in replacement of the rear passenger, well, both sides actually, smaller window side windows, and the air ducts that go straight into the engine bay. I've looked at that since they came out and went, oh, I'm doing that. I am 100% doing that. And then I thought, well, I mean, it's great to say that, but then there's obviously the kind of technical factor around it. Well, those things aren't designed to fit together. That's off a 718. I've got a 981. I'm not quite sure what the changes will need to be. I've got some of those GT4 RS parts, not those ones, but other GT4 RS parts in the car already, which I'll come to at a later date. And I can work with Jake at O Sport, who's going to be partnering on the Ren 550 build anyway. So there's an op so we've got options of how we're going to do it. But then when this popped up on Facebook, got the opportunity to see that someone's not beat me to it, because I'm not going to productionize this, but at the same time, it was really cool to see something that is not 4RS, but still utilizing those side intakes. And because I was, it would be a lot of money to invest into it without really knowing what the sound's going to be like afterwards. I've talked loads before about emotion and sound go hand in hand for me. I'm less bothered about outright power. I'm more bothered about the emotional connection, and a big part of that is the noise. And yes, it is just what I would hope. So it's phenomenal. Anyway, so there's no affiliation between myself and Gold Leaf Performance at all, but credit where credit's due, they've got out there. And I have, and I, what I will do is talk about some of the other things I've seen, because they weren't the first to do it, but I think they're the first to do it that looks factory. And as if you follow the channel or the podcast for a while now, you will know that anything I try and do has to be OEM plus or really, really close. Incidentally, when I was talking about updating or doing some slightly different content, it's kind of where I'm going to go. We start talking about my reflections of some of those modifications and whether I did them correct at the time or what I would do differently, whether I'm going to take things off. All of that stuff's going to come as part of those Ren Builds episodes. But to reflect back on some of the other stuff I've seen, so as I say, other people have done the side intakes, and some of them have done carbon fiber ones. They are very, to me, and it's only my personal opinion, and what's that worth? Not a great deal, but they look very motorsport. So they've got this big box that takes up some of the boot space. They've got the kind of big ducting, pipe ducting that kind of just snakes around into the boot. Now, I'm sure they're 100% effective and they do exactly what is being asked. But again, for me personally, I wouldn't want to lose some boot space. And I wouldn't want something to look motorsport, because my car's not a track car. It literally would be doing it for the sound and for the look. That's a lot of money spent. So if you're going to do it, for me personally, I'm not particularly attracted to the motorsport side of things. But if you've got a hardcore track car, go for it. But that's what Gold Leaf have done. It looks near identical to a GT4 RS. Obviously, you can't see below the surface, because what they have done is that. And I'll tell you what, I'll explain a little bit more about how it works. So, on a Cayman 981 and 718, you have, in fact, all of them 987s as well. You've got the engine sat behind the seats, an aluminium cover that sits on top of that, effectively, that goes around, that sits on the shell, and then on top of that, you've got some sound deadening and then carpet. The GT4 RS does away with a lot of that. And has this lovely big carbon fiber panel that sits on top of that engine panel. Obviously, that increases some noise and NVH, because the sound deadening is no longer there, or some of the sound deadening is no longer there. But then you get all of that amazing kind of mechanical noise coming through to the cabin. Not perfect for a daily. If you're just using your Cayman as something to nip to work and back, you probably won't want to do that. But for me, I've said this a million times, I'm a massive chav. I still get really excited about those sorts of things. So I think it's a brilliant thing, and well done to Gold Leaf Performance for knocking it out of the park. If you want to send me one, you are welcome, my friends, because that's a pretty big advert. 911 Ren Sport. So obviously we've moved into the new year now. We're kind of well into January. No one's saying Happy New Year to each other. that's all done. And I am starting to look at booking the rest of the year out. So we, Rensport and I had been talking on and off for the last sort of 8 months about me heading there and sitting down and doing a proper heritage episode about their whole, you know, what makes them tick, how did the whole company come about, and their products. And then going out for a run in one of the cars. Pleased to say that's the first of those sorts of pieces of content that's been booked for this year. So that's happening in early April. That's mega for me because this is the start of the change between, as I did, pop to Auto Farm and sat down in a lovely conversation with Mikey Wastey. But obviously they were a working workshop and it was in between different parts of the job for him. And there was not really a great opportunity because they had some things in build, but there's nothing that kind of we could have gone out in immediately. Whereas this, Rensport have demo cars and things like that. So it's going to give me the opportunity to start getting out and filming some of that stuff as well. So not only will there be content coming out about the conversation as well, but also there'll be content on the cars. So that's fantastic news. There is a lot more of that to come. That was the first booking. And I'm just starting to slate. I've got a big long list here in front of me. I won't read it out because at this point, unless they're in the bank and they're booked, I don't want to book to talk about it and if it doesn't go anywhere, which can also happen for lots of different reasons. And I respect people for their choices to whether they want to do it or not. But Rensport's booked. What else? Big for me, particularly, probably less. Well, it won't mean anything to you if you're international, and it will mean something to you if in the UK. But if you're not Hampshire based, it won't be quite as important. But Caffeine and Machine. If you are in, and I know I've got lots and lots and lots of Indian followers now. Hello to everyone in India. In this country, we have a. They've typically a company basically that turned a restaurant or a pub into a meeting ground for car enthusiasts. They have themed nights. Their social media and their marketing and their branding is perfect. It really has created their original kind of location in Stratford-upon-Avon in the UK. It took off like a rocket. It proved that everybody was hunting and needing that space that they could go that felt inclusive. That felt like you could just, and one of the taglines is feels like home, and it 100% does when you go to the Caffeine and Machine, or it does for me anyway. Not everything's for everybody, obviously, but yeah, I love Caffeine and Machine. So for me, great news because they've started branching out across the country, and they are opening a Caffeine and Machine location 15 minutes from my house. Which is just, I mean, you can imagine what I'm like a giddy school kid at this point with this. Not only because it is just a really cool place to go and hang out, but actually in terms of meeting people or just hanging out and doing a tech talk or a heritage episode or your Porsche story or another Rengineering Cars and Coffee event or a Legends event or something like that, there is another place that's fairly close to do that. So it'd be interesting. And just to dispel some myths as well, Caffeine and Machine pride themselves on promoting and loving all sorts of random weird stuff. So whereas typically you'd expect that the most expensive car wins because they tend to have almost like podiums and specific parking locations that have got a great backdrop for photos, actually quite often what happens is the really quirky stuff goes there, and the kind of more factory built off the, you know, run of the mill but very fancy cars, they get sort of placed elsewhere, which I love. So there's a good chance that I'll turn up in my modified VW app on its Porsche wheels low to the ground, and that'll get pride of place, whereas my Cayman, which is also tweaked and updated and changed, may not get the same presence, but that's fine with me. I'm quite happy with that. So that's Caffeine and Machine. Megaphonics tickets, again, big show in the UK. I've been to Megaphonics a few times, and if you haven't watched the Frank Cassidy heritage episode over on YouTube, you can go and do that now. That continues to be the most popular heritage episode so far, as Frank very kindly mentioned as well. Megaphonics tickets are now available, which is great. I will obviously be going. I've been every year bar one so far. I will continue to go. And a couple of other last things before we get into the Your Porsche Stories episode. One is a good friend of mine, Ajmal, who was on Porsche Cool. We met via that. We ended up hanging out and having a coffee, very random coffee, just turned up and just sat in a, you know, chewed the fat. And what turned out to be, what started off as let's meet up for 10 or 15 minutes or even half an hour, I think with a couple of hours just rabbiting on. So we obviously get on very well. We've stayed in touch ever since, and I've been on Mark and Ajmal's Porsche Talk podcast as well. So a little bit of a shout out for them. And I've asked Ajmal to come on this podcast as well. So probably we'll get myself, Mick and Ajmal together, and we'll, in much the same way that when Mick was on the channel, on the podcast just before Christmas with Nathan, we'll do something similar with Ajmal as well. And he can tell us about his 912, his garage build, because he's got this enormous garage being built on his house, not on his house, but in his back garden. Yeah, looking forward to that as well. Very good. So really that is it, pretty much, apart from getting my Cayman serviced. So that's now booked in with Barnsville again. God, what you'll find is that when I gravitate towards people, and if I think they're brilliant at what they do, they tend to just, I kind of stick to them, annoyingly probably for some people. But so my car's going back to Barnsville in April as well. It needs an annual service. It's only a small service, and I was talking to Scotty at Barnsville about booking it in. But I'm also going to do the GT3 RS steering flash for the ECU that manages the steering. So it'd be really interesting to see if I can feel the difference before and after. As I've said many times, I am, whilst I'm an engineer by trade, engineering covers a massive array of different arenas, so you can't necessarily be an expert in everything. If we were to try and measure and quantify the changes between pre-flash, post-flash, you'd have to have all sorts of things set up to do that properly. So it's going to be the equivalent of a bum dyno. Go out for driving it before, flash the car, take it out afterwards on the same day, and then try and sort of explain what the feeling is and if there is any difference. I'm assured by everybody on the internet that it's a remarkable difference, but we will see. Apparently it weights up the steering in a more kind of natural way. It's less assisted overall. There's all sorts of bits and pieces. So let's figure out and see what happens. And the last thing I'm going to mention is my new role in my day job. And I have said on Instagram that I don't tend to kind of merge the two, and it's not something that's going to happen regularly, but it does mean something in terms of re-engineering and what happens here as well. Re-engineering, if you've listened to any of the really early stuff, and I start talking about the purpose of re-engineering, whilst it's great putting out content around heritage, tech talk, Your Porsche Stories, all of that stuff's fantastic, all REM builds, the purpose of all of it, even after building the REM 550, is to create an opportunity for young engineers to come on board, to experience what it's like working in a project environment, to support one of the builds. At the end of that process, the intention was it to be a yearly process, but I'm realizing now that actually the required amount of time it would take for me, I'd have to be full-time. But if that was to happen, out of that group of engineers, myself and the two people that kind of in the background of engineering that aren't front-facing, would decide between us who the MVP is for that year. And provided it could be funded, the intention was, the kind of blue sky thinking was, that we would pay for their master's degree. So that's the whole point. Where does that cross over with my day job? Well, my day job now, or as of middle of February, is to be the STEM outreach program manager for the company I work for, which is amazing. So I will get to go to schools, colleges, even universities probably in some cases, the Institution of Engineering and Technology that I'm a full member of, all sorts of places, and collaborating with industry as well to start promoting STEM roles and STEM activity and STEM careers, basically. So I'm not doing the greatest job of showing how excited, because I'm a bit fatigued from being excited about it, but it is by far the most excited I've been about a job ever. The idea that I get to go and talk about my route into engineering and to explain how that happened, the fact that I wasn't a straight A student, the fact that I left it quite late in my life to start, to start training and becoming an engineer, all of those things will probably help some parts of society where they've had no experience or there's preconceived ideas about what you can and can't do based on where you are at that point in your life. That's the stuff I'm really excited about. So that's happening for me outside of engineering as well. For now though, let's have a quick check of the time. 19 minutes in. So this is going to be a mega episode. I hope you've taken a comfort break, or if you need a comfort break, do that now. And I will hand over to myself and Ross from New Zealand to talk about your Porsche story, and I'll be back at the end. Welcome back to the Reengineering YouTube and podcast, and welcome to another Your Porsche Stories. Today I'm with Ross, who comes from New Zealand. Although Ross has sent me a ton of stuff, images, backstory, everything about his 72 911T, I deliberately haven't read too much into it because I want to get it from him firsthand. So welcome, Ross. How are you today? All good.
G'day, Paul. Welcome from New Zealand. Yeah, lovely, lovely day here. Yeah, and hell of a journey with this old car.
Yeah. Okay. So, if you remind me again, did you see this on YouTube and reach out from YouTube, or was it from a podcast streaming service? Which version did you pick up?
I think I came across you on YouTube and reached out that way. I came across your email somehow. I think I shot you an email and said,
"Perfect.
Hey, here I am. It's probably a good time to as much a bit for my own purposes, I suppose, to record a bit about what this journey has been like. And you know, there's a lot of information that's gone through my head over the last 5 years or so. And I've started documenting some of it. But good idea to talk about it and record something.
Yeah, and I'm sure once you get into the conversation, things that you have experienced or had to handle in terms of changes or decisions you've made, or difficult parts to it that will come back through, that all stuff will come back flooding through once you start talking about it. So, but before we get into the current car, as with all of these episodes, can I take you back to your youth and give me a heads up as to cars and where they came in, and then Porsche in terms of where their Porsche brand came to you. Yeah. Tell me about that.
Yeah, sure. I've loved skiing since I've been a young guy, and on a ski trip with a mate that I met when I was a junior engineer at Tech. His dad was in fact a racer of some renown in New Zealand, a chap sadly no longer with us, but a guy called Cary Grant. And he was a single seater racer and a well known saloon car racer in the '60s and into the early '70s. He had a couple of accidents. But his son, Andrew, and I, was a good mate. He still is a really good friend of mine. And we were on a ski trip, and his dad had loaned us an Audi 80 Quattro, which in 1987, wow, 2.2
beast of a car engine.
Well, with skiing is such an improbable sport, getting up and down the mountain and, snow and stuff, and a powerful four-wheel drive car was a bit of an unheard thing of, back those in those days. And it was a fantastic trip. I remember flying along at speeds the family car didn't do, and it really made an impression. So Andrew's dad actually had a 3-2 Carrera in his garage at one point in time, as well as an Ua Quattro. He was a real through and through car guy, and that's what really sparked my interest in cars. And
how old were you about this sort of time?
18 or 19. Okay. Or 19, so fairly late into it, I suppose. But you pick up and learn a lot along the way. I don't work in the industry, but like Jeff in Sydney, we're just enthusiasts that have learned a lot through the journey of having and owning your own cars. My first car was a Fiat 125, a boxy saloon. Really good first car, twin overcam Lampredi engine. I did subsequently have a BMW 2002 Ti.
Nice car. One of my best friends has got one of those. I think it's a 74. I want to say 74.
Right. Right. Mine was a 71 roundy, so it was sort of the in-between model. But being a TI, it was, you know, probably the rarest of them because it was twin side draft Solexes, not the injected, the Kugelfisch injected TII. But yeah, that car's still around somewhere. But I did learn an awful lot through that process of really what not to do in many ways. You know, the car still wasn't quite where it needed to be at the end of a rolling restoration over, you know, a number of years, and decided if I was going to do a 911, it had to be to a much higher standard. And it's also a passion project, really. Something that you are doing for love, not really for money. So it's been my project on my terms, and that operating the project with that in mind has meant that it's for my enjoyment. And you know, it's not an expensive, it's not an inexpensive or easy undertaking at all, quite the opposite actually. But you know, as of yesterday, it's registered and on the road. We are there. Wow. So you know, the end of 5 years, 5 year journey is complete.
It's interesting because picking up on a couple of things you've said so far, one is talking about being a young engineer, and the other is you talked about project. Now, project can mean lots of different things to lots of different people. It can mean, you know, throwing a bit of cash at it whenever you can, and that invariably takes 20 years to get through something. A full restoration from scratch from somebody that's got an engineering background sounds like more of a thought through, you know, figured out process. You know what you're going to do and when, you know roughly how long it's going to take you, you've got a vague idea of budget, those sorts of basic things. Was it that kind of thought through, or was it more of a passion project kind of, yeah, I'll just take it as it comes and figure things out? How did it start?
More the latter. I mean, the car was sold to me, it's a US car originally, a 1972 TE, so mechanical fuel injection. But it was sold to me as a project, just bolt an engine in and go. And as it turned out, nothing could be further from the truth.
Right.
I actually bought the car when I was living in Melbourne and shipped it with my personal fix with an engine to New Zealand. And then they worked out a good machinist here, or a body shop rather, that I wanted to have a look at it. He said, well, let's just cut the sills off and have a look, and you know, it was heart in the mouth moment. It's like, oh my god, because it had been repainted and it actually looked quite sharp. But when you peeled back a little bit, it was pretty clear it was not what it was sold as.
I wonder with those things whether it's because it hit that kind of, you know, as all cars do, that weird part in between being desirable again. You know, they were desirable for a while, but then the equity wasn't really in them to spend vast amounts of money like there is now. So they get kind of the standard. And we've got it over here with, you know, most classic cars, but particularly Minis are ripe for it because they were a really cheap throwaway car. So people would just stuck, you know, patches on them, or you'd find bits of rolled up newspaper and glue and all sorts of bodge tape, all sorts of rubbish. And some of it can look quite convincing from a distance. And it's really, like you said, it's only when you get to start taking things off and investigating that you realize that, oh no, it's another candidate that's going to need a full restoration work. So
There was definitely a period there where there was quite a bit of soul searching around, well, it's not what I thought. What do I want to do as a consequence? Do I just put a bow around it and re-advertise it or actually commit to this project and really... really dig quite deep, and I decided the latter. So we, you know, it ended up with floors and sills and the, you know, front battery boxes and the tank support. It had new guards already. I think they looked fairly not original to the car, but Porsche parts. Yeah. But they just looked like they didn't need you know, any attention. But it was, you know, probably 250, 300 hours of welding and steel work. But the nice thing, one of the really nice things about restoring an old 911 is the availability of parts is fantastic. You don't have to custom fabricate much at all.
Yeah.
Restoration Designs in Canada have patch panels for nearly all of the car, or from Porsche themselves. Still takes, you know, it still takes a real craftsman to put it together and to get a straight, just really straight body out of it. But I was very happy with the, you know, how straight and rust free the tub ended up at the end of that. You know, it was 18 months in the body shop by the time we decided, you know, originally cutting it open to when it rolled out and you move on to the next phase of the project.
Do you know if they were doing multiple builds at once, or they can't have been working on your car solo for 18 months?
No. It's a smaller workshop. You know, he runs it as a business, but he's a small time operator. Mm. But he's got it's Pegasus Restorations actually here in Christchurch. Okay. And a really, really good guy, Alex, who's done a lot of these early 911s and V-dubs before, knows them inside out. You know, you really need someone that knows how these cars
are. I'll make sure I tag Pegasus when I put the post out, when I put the video out, because it's great exposure for them, especially if they're, you know, they're looking for other projects. I don't know, but...
Yeah, look, he does. I was actually there yesterday. We were doing a few break-in miles on the engine, and... with my son just driving around a little bit to get a few miles on it, and went to see Alex to show him the finished product. And he's got a 3-liter SC Targa in there as a project car. You know, he's got always got a few early 911s coming and going, VW Combi buses and things. He's got a couple of guys working for him now, so things are quite busy for him. But no, he's a great, you know, a good local restoration shop. That does quality work at a decent price.
You mentioned it had been repainted. So what was the original color? What had it been painted, and what have you gone to, back to, or to from there?
It was always a light ivory car. It had been painted light ivory, and I actually vacillated on color for a long time when it came around to painting the car. I went around and around and around in my head on, you know, whether to go with an original Porsche color or just to paint it refrigerator white or washing machine white again. I know a lot of the race cars have got a certain appeal with that, you know, the white color, the 911Rs and things. But there was a particular picture in from the US of an early 911 painted in a modern sort of take on a slate gray color. And it's if you Google Dolomite Grey early 911, this narrow body car pops up, and it just looks stunning. It really caught my eye, and I just couldn't get past these pictures of this car. And I thought, well, you know, that's it. I'm going with that. So it's not a Concours project. I didn't want to be constrained by you know, the limitations of putting together a car that's going to live in a garage the rest of its life and not be driven. That's really not me. I really want to enjoy this thing, having put all this time and effort into it. So it is modified a little bit from standard. You know, it's now got slightly upgraded suspension. It's lowered a little bit. It has some sports Recaro seats. It's got a 2.7 RS high compression engine. Which I actually assembled the engine myself, which was hugely rewarding project. That was
first foray into building,
Well, I've had the heads off cars before, you know, tuned carburetors and did a lot with the 2002. We did do an engine build on that, but not to the same extent as the early 911. Just on the engine building side of it, I will say that you know, the actual assembly of the parts, assembling the engine, is nothing like as critical as the machining work that needs to go into getting everything absolutely correct. You know, the fact that there's six separate cylinders and heads that all need to be exactly flat for the cam tower to sit across to make a nice smooth running engine. You know, you can't be too careful with making sure everything is exactly parallel. So you need somebody that understands the architecture of these things. And so I bought some 7R cases through the forums, actually, in the States, and had them prepared by Ollie's in Arizona and shuffle pinned. You know, I figured either you build a standard 72 TE engine, a 2.4 TE, or if you're going to modify it, then the costs to modify it are more or less the same, whatever spec of porting you do, whatever new cams you put into it. So I decided to go, you know, the full hog and do a 2.7 RS, high compression 2.7 RS.
Amazing. So especially if you already made the decision to go in a different direction with paint, and the suspension is going to be slightly different, and if you're putting an engine in it, then you kind of, the shackles are off a little bit. Jeff and I talked about this a little bit, but as well, you know, there's something freeing about not constraining yourself to a nut and bolt restoration using every single original part, as you know, or you know, reclaiming as much of the original stuff as you can, because like you said, you know, you're going to be in this situation where you've got this not priceless but incredibly difficult to replace car that then isn't as enjoyable as something that, where you kind of, you might not be chasing full resto mod singer-esque stuff, but you know, having your own stamp on it for your car that is suited to your driving style, your environment, you know, all those sorts of things, it must be a really enjoyable place to be, getting to the, you know, when you come towards the end of the road and you've made those decisions and you've got all that part, those parts, and they've, you know, the car's built, and you look back and go, wow, you know, this thing is now mine. It's got my thumbprints, blood, sweat, tears, you know, every argument you've ever had with your partner or your kids or, you know, anyone, your next door neighbor, because you've been, you know, banging away at like 4 a.m. or whatever it is, you know, all of those things suddenly, for me anyway, it's that moment where it's, you know, that you put the wrench down for the last time and you're like, I think we're done, you know, that moment.
I need to give a bit of clarity there. You know, Jeff, in my mind, is an absolute legend. You know, his work rate and throughput, because he's done absolutely everything.
Effortlessly modest as well. It's unbelievable when you talk to him and he talks about, you know, the first thing he said was, I'm just an idiot with a spanner, you know, like really downplays his skill set. So
yeah, and show me a fireman who's got painting skills, and by the way, can troubleshoot a wiring diagram and wire up a link computer and troubleshoot when it's not running right and do it just in a conversation like it's just every day.
Unfinished projects. The amount of people that start stuff and then get distracted by, you know, the shiny new thing that comes along. But he's a finisher. His projects get finished.
As a wise man said to me once, it's really easy to start a project, it's difficult to finish, and I have to agree with that completely. Yeah. There was a moment a couple of years ago, probably 3 years ago now, where I had a lockup when I was doing, you know, collecting all the parts and bits and pieces, and I can't remember which piece it was, but I'd been through it and worked out the repair strategy and put it on the shelf, and I knew what needed to be done with it. I picked it up 8 months later and I couldn't for the life of me remember what it was. It took me 4 or 5 days to remember what I decided to do with this particular piece. And then a while later, a few months later, the same thing happened again. And it dawned on me that this project is going to get out of control unless I really commit to it and dig deep and really make sure that this thing gets over the finish line. Because you can see how projects sit for 10 years and get half done.
Because like, you know, the reality is, you know, that unless you're dedicating yourself, I guess it's slightly different if you're retired, but if you're a working person and you've got commitments, family commitments, or just a social life, you know, or anything really, you're sacrificing those things to dedicate yourself to completing the tasks that you need to get completed to build the car. So there is always a push and pull in terms of, and I get it, you know, if you know, I certainly wouldn't judge anybody for not completing something, or when you go, you know, to eBay or Craigslist or whatever else and you see a load of half finished projects, you totally get why, because somebody's got to that point where, you know, it's not tolerable to compete, you know, your working life and your home life and everything else for this one thing that it's just four wheels and a steering wheel at the end of the day. It isn't as important as your relationships, and it's not as important as your work and all those sorts of things that compete against it. So I get it. I totally get it.
It's you do have to keep it in context. I'm too stubborn. You need a fair degree of grit to get it to the finish line, and it's always been about
about seeing it through to completion. And there have been some, you know, I just have to say, this is me for the time being. There's other things I...
Where did that happen? Tell me about a bit more about that. Where did it get to the point, or what points did it get when you were like, ugh, I can't be dealing with this anymore?
I think, you know, we're in the paint shop and I'm in overalls, just finished an IT contract. And you just realize how many hours it takes to actually get the body shell. Even once all the metalwork's done, there's a long way to a painted shell. There's still a lot of hours to get to a really good quality paint job. And at that point, you're looking at it going, well, it's nearly a car, but I've got to reassemble everything. Although I had, you know, at that point, I had been going through every single component and refurbishing it along the way. I've got receipts from the powder coaters and the platers. You know, I went through the other day and put all the receipts into a folder, and it's a massive number. You know, there's dozens of trips to the powder coaters and the platers just with piles of parts.
Did they? So you know, post build before, when I was chatting to the powder coater that I use, you know, they were like, if you'd have just brought all this stuff in like two or three trips, you'd have saved so much money.
True, but that also assumes you're gonna pull everything apart and have it on one pile, and that's fine if you can look at a part and go, that goes there. I had to be a little structured in the way that I just assembled the car, knowing that I was going to put it back together again. So I needed a sense of organisation about the project, so that I could put everything back where it needed to go. Without ending up in trouble.
The bonus of another YouTube channel is that you get some video of everything, and then worst case scenario, if you do lose your mind and you can't remember. It's a case of going back on YouTube and having a look at one of the earlier episodes and figuring it out from there. But
you make a really, really good point there, Paul. And I want to reinforce that this project has been a project of the internet. The depth of resource available through Pelican Parts and others that Cavs 911, I think he's in North Carolina, it's North California somewhere. I watched his videos end to end. Kurt from Parts Classic has done a lot of videos on particularly the engine. So I was going to do it myself. I just, when I committed to do that, I invested a huge amount of hours in just studying how the thing went together, needed to be checked, you know, what the critical aspects were, were there any special tools that would help you along the way. And all that's possible through the internet, and you know, those people that have gone before, you know, it's so much easier. When I came to assemble the engine, it was like, I've been here, I've done this three times myself, because in my head I had, you know, I'd been through exactly what I needed to do, and it's still, when you're actually got your own hands on your own parts, it's a bit you know, in tools, it's a bit different, but it came together really, really well, you know.
Really.
So it took a lot of time and care assembling them, you know, the engine itself. But when you're not running it as a commercial enterprise and it is just a hobby, you've got the luxury of time, and you can make sure that everything is absolutely right. You know, there are some critical checks, the deck height and the piston to head clearance, in particular, and the piston to valve clearance. Just make sure those things are all safe and you've got good clearance. But in terms of the spec of the engine, I mean, I love the engine, I suppose, more than any other part of the car, sort of where I've invested more time and technical insight than anything else. And I did a lot of research into the 2.7 RS engine, and just as a side note, you know, I find it fascinating that the early reports really talked about the improved torque of the 2.7 versus anything that had gone before, but that was Porsche's first homologation engine. You know, it was their first homologated car for GT racing, and for it to be known for its torque more though than its horsepower.
Surprising, isn't it? Yeah, it'd be quite linear, and it would all be at the sort of 6 to 7, 6 to 8, that kind of area. But
Yeah, yeah, they did leave a lot on the table. You can tune up a 2.7 RS engine, you know, the standard 8.5 to 1 compression ratio. There is certainly some breathing improvements that you can, you know, a good 2.7 RS is good for, you know, probably at least 225, 230 horsepower if you raise the compression, run it on high octane gas. Because back in the day, they were just run on two star fuel, which I think the environment, the climate of the world in that point was around, you know, the fuel crisis was happening, and it was not as tuned up as it might sound for a homologation car. There are you know, having done a couple of hundred miles in the thing now, it's a beautiful engine, loads of torque actually, more than I would have anticipated. And the MFI system really does, it is kind of old tech, but devastatingly effective. The throttle response and the way it works, you know, the sensation you get driving the car is just really, really something else.
Have you, you obviously have had some time on the dyno to get it set up and stuff. So have you had a power run and a torque run to be able to get those figures down?
No, I don't. In fact, we've still got the RPM limit set just at 5.8 just for running. But it's still pulling like mad when it hits the rev limiter. But it feels really quick, even pulling to, you know, just under 6,000 RPM. And still 1,500 RPM to go. So, yeah, looking forward to really getting some numbers. I have actually twin plugged it. So we have twin plugged the heads and put in a second CDI box, and in the process of sorting out a twin plug distributor. And what I would like to do is, when we get it properly run in single plug, is then retune it for twin plug and do a back-to-back comparison, single plug versus twin plug, just to see. I don't think there's huge benefits power-wise, but, you know, in the process of investigating the engine, I spoke to three different engine builders in the States, guys that are really well-known in the US market, a guy called Steve Weiner, who unfortunately passed away in the last 12 months, Henry at Supertech, you know, a really well-known guy, and then another guy, William Knight, who... is also really well known on the forums and builds, you know, cracking engines, particularly 3 liters, but also, you know, he's got a lot of experience with early Porsche engines. It's one thing, just talking about the, you know, the engineering side of these engines, I approached a couple of people in the early days and said, well, you know, what would you do if I was going to build a 2.7 engine? And they look at me blankly and go, well, what do you want to do? We're just, you know, we bolt it together. The engineering, there's a big gap between a mechanic, someone who can fix problems and bolt things together, and someone who's done the research to know, well, what is the safe compression ratio? How much cam should you put in a 2.7 RS with a magnesium case for it to be safe? You know, what do you go? Do you need Nicosil liners? You know, what are the best piston cylinder combinations? You know, that knowledge isn't on the streets or at your local independent workshop. The mechanics, not engineers, and you have to go away and talk to a lot of people to get that knowledge. And I had to do that offshore. There are some people around that know more than others here, but there's such a
difference. It's a small industry, right? In New Zealand and even Australia, that whole concept is not going to have tens of thousands of 911s running around, so it's gonna, you know, it's natural the States is going to have the vast majority of people that have really invested a lot of time, and there's a whole industry that's set up around it, so it makes total sense that you go there, right? And did you fly out at all, or was this all done over the, you know, emails, internet, phone calls?
Emails and internet. And the approachability as well, you know, the Porsche community is fantastic. There's a you know, I find air-cooled people, Porsche people, are very, very open generally with information, very, very happy to talk about what they've done, what they think's best, what their experience is. There are, you know, when it came to actually properly tuning the engine, this MFI thing is potentially really complicated. You can get yourself really mixed up, and it was running poorly to start with, and it took a fair bit to... to get it tuned properly. I reached out to yet another expert that I'd come across in the forums, a guy in the US again, and he pointed me in the right direction about how to set up the MFI properly. And once I made a couple of simple changes, it took, you know, I say simple, but it took probably 5 or 6 hours of tuning to get it
really
absolutely spot on, to really go through the whole thing, you know, the fueling system end to end, and understand exactly what's happening to get it.
Was this
right
on a bench, or was this, you know, a bit of static and a bit of road driving and a bit more static and a bit more?
Get it idling properly. But you need an airflow AFR meter, airflow ratio meter. Which I didn't have back in the day. 50 years ago, those things weren't around, but we've got the luxury these days of being able to tune with those. I'd had some bungs put in the SSI headers. And so because I knew we would need to do some road tuning. And I got my son sitting beside me calling out the numbers as we're driving along.
Amazing.
And the main thing with MFI is that, you know, 12.5, 13 to 1, when you really third gear, foot flat to the floor. So it's getting the fuel when the engine is most stressed that it needs. Mm-hmm. And the air fuel ratio just sits where it will be for the rest of it. They do run particularly rich at lower RPM, but interestingly, that helps keep an air cooled engine together. You have to be a bit conscious of temperature management, being air and oil cooled. So if you run it too lean, you know, it's quite easy to get into a detonation situation.
Yeah, but they're
pretty noisy, clattery things, and you wouldn't necessarily hear it, so you gotta be careful.
Okay, it's funny because when I smiled a minute ago, I don't know if you're listening to this, you've seen me smile clearly. If you're watching it, you would have. But that was when you talked about you and your son doing some of that tuning, and how everyone's different. Obviously, everyone's relationships are different. But did you find that a bonding exercise, the two of you kind of seeing that over the finish line and hanging out together and just, you know, all that stuff?
Absolutely. You know, he was with me yesterday doing a few miles around town, and it's he's been with me the whole journey. In fact, I've got some photo footage. Back in the early days, I had all the throttle bodies apart, and he was asking me why there was six lots of everything, you know, and I had to explain to him, you know, what that means, how that works. So, you know, he's been with me on this journey as much as
amazing.
A 7, 8, 9 year old boy can be, but I would have loved it when I was that age. Depends how the kid's wired, but you know, he seems
of course, and you can't ram it down their throat. You've got to let them kind of explore it on their own terms, but at the same time, guarantee as he grows older, you know, and he hits his 20s, or you know, and you're an older gentleman, and you know, you're probably less inclined to go out and smash the thing around, and he's kind of nudging you every now and again and talking about the car, and you know, and one day that then, you know, potentially end up his, or you know, and that those things are then even more meaningful, you know, the experience of building it together, the experience of tuning it up together, hanging out, and then that day where, you know, it becomes part of his property. That you can't, I guarantee all, you know, every penny that you've ever spent on that car will just pales into insignificance to the meaningfulness of the relationship and that journey, you know.
Yeah, you're so right. I have to be aware that it's my project and not to ram it down his throat. That he, you know, if he's interested, he's welcome. So he has to, you know, let him engage with it on his terms. He's still only 9.5, so you know, he's a young guy. He was particularly fascinated. I have put aftermarket CDI boxes into a computer, tune things, and he was particularly fascinated when we hooked up the laptop and were configuring some of the settings in the tuning of the CDI boxes, and I thought that was pretty cool. But it's still an old car for him. I know he doesn't, you know, fully appreciate.
Yeah.
He knows that 911s are a little bit different, and old air cool things are a little bit different too. But in the fullness of time, I think, you know, if he has the same love for the tech and stuff that I do, then he'll get to enjoy it a lot more. One day he'll get to drive it. It'll be a long time before he'll have to have a cheap Toyota Corolla or something before.
So picking this up again, Ross's son just literally popped on camera just as we kind of took a quick break. So, Sam is his name. Is that what his name was?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
What a
100%.
hero! What a hero!
One boy, one and done.
Yeah, good for you. Let's pick some more conversation up about the car, because we've talked about the color, we've talked about the engine build. Talk me through the interior. What interior choices? You mentioned, I think you mentioned Recaros, is that right?
Yeah, so the car originally had comfort seats, and I don't have a great love for the seats that were in it. Look, the car as a project, just taking a step back, the car as a project was a very, very original car. It hadn't been hacked around with at all. It just didn't have an engine. So all the interior was there, including the comfort seats. So a really good basis from which to restore a car. I don't know if you follow the value of the seats, but the sports seats that were an option in the early 911s are crazy expensive,
Are
just
they?
unbelievably pricey. There was a pair that were original, had Pepita inserts, I think, for a 67S. But just an old pair of Recaro seats, and they sold on Bring a Trailer about 3 months ago now for $30,000.
No, $30,000 for a Paris. That is unbelievable.
It is just off the hook. And but they're not actually the greatest seats in the world as
No.
far as comfort or performance goes. So I have put some, and it's probably the most contentious part of the car that I've built is the Recaro LSC seats that were available from the late 70s or early 80s. Back in the early 70s, you got the comfort seats, or you got the sports seats, but there was another more bolstered reclining seat called the Idealsitz S, and that was available in Germany, I understand, through the dealer network. You could specify it when you bought the car. So this is like a modern kind of take on those seats. The rest of it, so it's got a Momo wheel, 370 millimeter, slightly bigger one. Getting the seats to fit actually was actually quite tricky because they changed the mounting system, and the comfort seats, you sit quite high. Anyway, I've made some adapters, and we sit a bit lower, and it works a lot better. And it's really, they are very, very functional and comfortable, and look quite good.
What color did you go for spec in terms of seat panels and exterior?
Well, the Pepita inserts, so
Okay, cool.
and leather, just black leather,
Black
black
leather.
leather. So yeah, so the interior of the car is more or less black carpet, black side panels. So it's got lightweight door panels.
Yeah.
We did put the rear seats back into it, just to make it more of a usable proposition. I know some people. I didn't, in terms of the concept of the build, I didn't want it to be, fully stripped out, widened, wannabe race car kind of thing. It's narrow body. I've kept it narrow body, but it does run on 7-inch wide wheels.
That's my favorite look, by the way. I love a narrow body with chunky wheels. It's got that kind of, mini muscle car thing going on when it's like that. Sometimes I think the wide body stuff, it unless you really nail it, it can look a bit either a bit lost or it just doesn't quite know what it's going to be, like, especially if it's a road car and primarily a road car. Yeah, spot on in terms of choice.
It's hard to get right. Do you put SC flares on it? Do you put RS flares on it? Do you go the ST look? And they're all subtly different. And Porsche people, being Porsche people, they know the difference. So, for me, I never wanted it to be a wannabe race car. It's a it's first and foremost a road car, but it definitely will be trackable. And a hell of a lot of fun to drive. It just is,
And you're
the
only
very
just
first.
winding up, right? You like it's
Yeah.
It's a claim to say that right now when you're running it in. So you can imagine what it's going to be like when it's fully run in and drop the oil. It's gone through probably, two more oil changes and it's really starting to loosen up and you exercise all the rev range and it's, everything's bedded in properly. And then you can start taking it out and you've got some amazing scenery near you. So yeah,
Oh yeah.
it's going to be
Yeah,
phenomenal.
yeah, yeah. That's what I'm really looking forward to is, getting some driving miles under the belt and actually using it as a thing to get out and drive and enjoy. There's wonderful driving roads in the South Island here on the West Coast in particular. So yeah, there's a lot to look forward to there. Yeah, no, it's but the first drive around the block when I actually, because you don't know how it was going to come together. It's got
Of
turbo
course.
torsion bars in the back, so
Right.
it's a bit stiffer in the back, and it's got Bilstein sport shocks, so it sits pretty firmly on the road. But the first lap around the block that I did probably 6 8 months ago now, I got back. It was just like, oh my God, what have I created? She's
Really?
a beautiful
Wow.
thing to look at, but
Yeah.
oh my God, does this thing drive like a nutter? It's just off the hook. It really is. The way it
Yeah.
accelerates and turns and changes direction, it's like nothing. Yeah, short of having a co-driver seat in a rally car, it's such
Wow.
an engaging car to drive. It really is.
What, so talk to me
Everything.
about geometry and tires then, because if it's driving that well, again, driving that well straight out of the box, did you spend much time getting it set up in terms of dialing the suspension in, or has it been, you've just gone for a basic setup and you'll just drive it and figure out where it needs to be after that? And what tires did you go for?
Yeah, well, in terms of suspension setup, I'd say we're more than halfway through. I think it's still got too much toe in it, and I have been liaising with some guys in the States about what the best sort of setup is. I don't want the ride height slammed too low. You want to
No.
maintain some compliance with it, some movement. So it's running a bit over a degree of negative camber in the back. We need a bit more with the 7-inch wheels. You want to dial a bit of toe out in the front. The caster is not adjustable in the front, but the
Okay.
camber kind of moves with the toe a little bit. So I do have to get the muck around with the rear torsion bars and get them just right. There's the right-hand side is riding a little higher than the left. So we've got a little bit of playing around to do there to get it dialed in. It drives really well, but we can improve it a wee bit. It's a little bit darty at speed. Once you get above about 70 miles an hour on a rougher road, it moves around a fair bit. So we just need to dial that in. In terms of tires, with 15-inch wheels, you are restricted a bit, but I always wanted 15s. But there is a Bridgestone REO, I think it's an RE003, available in a 205. What is it? It's a 205 55 15. So it has the effect of shortening the gearing a little bit, as well as lowering the car and stiffening the ride a wee bit from standard. But just on tires, these early cars 50 years ago, tire technology was just nowhere. And
No, of
I
course,
think
yeah. Cross-ply
I think
Dunlops that were kind of, shed their skin after, 10,000 miles and there'd be absolutely nothing left of them, and rubber
I've
compounds,
come.
not even that, but variable compounds across the tread and all sorts of things that you just would never even have heard of back in the day. So.
And it does, a fast road tire, matched with an early 911, you get a lot of mechanical grip out of a relatively narrow chassis, that would have been pretty unthinkable, way back when. So there's a, you know, it does really help an early 911 in terms of its handling dynamics, putting some good sport tires on. It's early days, I haven't really pushed the car much through corners, but those that I have, it really comes into its own when you load up suspension a little bit. It really just squats in the back a little bit and you start getting quite a bit of feedback from the rear end and the front lightens up. It's going to be a lot of fun to drive. I can't wait to actually get it on track
I bet.
and actually put in some,
Some
learn
proper
to learn.
miles.
Yeah, learn where the limits are a little bit and drive it properly. I've got a harness bar and some harnesses ready to go.
So good.
Get those into good. Eventually.
Have you got any friends, sort of, or is there a local group to you that you kind of you're able to spend time with other people that have got 911s, or is it you kind of your lone wolf out there stalking in the
yeah,
night?
I think as far as people that are as deep into it as I am, I think it's probably just me.
That's you. You know,
I was at a Porsche Club meeting on Sunday last weekend, and you know, people open the hood and like, wow, what's that funny pump? What's the MFI pump? And
right,
oh, well, what's that all about again? And you know, just the depth of knowledge. Even you know, I don't think I'd even trust some of the local mechanics to actually tune the engine properly. The boys just don't know. They go and research it, but
yeah,
I can do that myself. So
of course,
you know, I am, you know, a bit of a lone wolf. Having said that, there is a guy that I've met in the States. He married a Kiwi girl, and in fact, he arrived in the country about 2 hours ago. So him and I are going for a drive this afternoon. His dad actually owned an original TR, so 68 TR, you know, one of the 32, I think, homologated cars. Were they homologated, or they might have just been?
You're going to be teaching me at this point, honestly. So in a lot of these conversations, I make noises like I sound like I know what I'm talking about, but really what I'm actually doing is learning. So when you say things like that, I'm like, cool, okay, you tell me.
I mean, the history of the early 911 is an interesting thing. You know, that what amazes me is that Porsche had this incredible race program in the 60s, and they were competing, you know, in the full on races. But they never really supported GT racing until the 70s with the 911. It wasn't until they homologated the 911 with the 2.7 RS that it was a homologated car.
Mm.
For a company the size of what it was in the 60s, they did amazing things with their race team, and their race program was just you know, really, really fantastic. But there was a few 911s that were modified, the original 911R, and then the TR, which came in 68, I think, the last of the short wheelbase cars, and then the ST program. The STs are an interesting group. I think there's more to it than just the name, but then the 2.7 RS became the RSR when Porsche really made its name in GT racing in the 70s. Once they decided they wanted to go racing with the 911, is when the reputation really was cemented. You know, back in the 60s they had the race program, and the 911 was the only product they had, but it was a road car.
Yeah.
And that ended, you know, in 1979 at Le Mans, where they won outright against all the prototype cars. You know, the fact that a road based car had beaten all the prototypes was, you know, an amazing feat.
So I need to one of the things I've been meaning to do, and it's just so time consuming, is that I haven't done it yet. But when I get a gap, I will. Maybe in the new year, actually, I'll have an opportunity to. Is the heritage playlist that I've started to put together? The intention is to sort of start doing some research into Ferry Porsche, like the very earliest days, and then kind of do some episodes where I'm kind of talking through what I've learned and sharing that, and then asking for some feedback about what I've missed, that sort of thing. But literally doing it step by step all the way through to the modern day. So it'd be interesting, probably, because you sound certainly convincing me that your knowledge is pretty up there. So maybe Ross, if you're up for it, when I get to this period of where your knowledge is at its best, you come back on and we have a better conversation when I've done my research.
Yeah, love to. Look, I don't there's other people that know an awful lot more than me, but I do find it a fascinating period of history, and how Porsche transformed itself from you know, what they did with the 911, I guess, in its final form, and the 935 was you know, so an amazing journey. You know, it was developed, you know, extensively, and the technology they used, they you know, an amazing company, the way they thought and the way they did things, very engineering led.
It's interesting. Have you been over to the UK much? Because I'm so close to Goodwood, and I've said this before, and I stand by it. It's, we're so spoiled over here in terms of the cars, the special stuff that turns up for the Festival of Speed, but Revival mainly for some of the historic cars. You know, they're Le Mans winning cars, and you know, and you're inches away from them, and without any kind of real barricade, there's no kind of armed guard stood next to them. And yeah, you hear the odd story about one or two of them being clones of the original, and you'd understand why. But for the most part, I'm pretty sure the original cars get raced around Goodwood. You know, have you been over here and had an opportunity to see any of that, or not so much? Not
Look,
yet.
I'm sitting here with a blank face, but inside I'm green with envy, mate.
Yeah, I bet.
I just, you know, Goodwood and the whole the idea of the classic racing, the 2 liter cup is fascinating. But yeah, I would absolutely be in my element and amongst that. I have been to the UK a few times, but not really so much in a car capacity. Been skiing with a few mates a few times and got a few friends over there, but yeah. For sure, I would. My dream would be to take the car to Europe and spend a summer,
Touring
in
round.
Europe. You know, yeah, touring around. You know, get some drives in the Alps and visit some places and get amongst it at the likes of Goodwood. I think that would be, you know, that would be
Phenomenal, yeah.
living
And
the dream for me.
actually, what? So this year, I think it was, when was it? July. It would have been July. I did a solo road trip through France into the Alps, and that those episodes are going to go live over Christmas.
Oh, brilliant.
And it was life changing. Sounds really dramatic, but it really was. It was, you know, I drove through Col de la Bonnette, highest loop road in Europe. And I, you know, pulled up at the top, and there's all these mountain ranges below where I am, cloud base below where I am, you know, and I've got the drone out, I'm flying the drone around and kind of getting all these amazing shots and stuff. And then literally what pulls around the corner. And I had, bear in mind, driving all the way through France, I'd probably seen one Cayenne and a Macan or something like that. That's it. And then three G bodies just come snaking around the corner as soon as I pulled up to the crest. And it just was one of those moments that you can't recreate that stuff. It was, yeah. So it's massively expensive, I'm sure, to ship a car over from New Zealand to Europe to do that. But yeah, I don't think you'll ever regret it in a million years. It's amazing.
I mean, you only live once, and you know, you I don't think you lie on your deathbed wondering about things, you know, regretting things that you've done. I think you
Your
only
late
regret the
tax
things
return is not going to be on your
you
mind when
didn't
you
do.
come. No.
No, my late dear mother died about my age, actually, you know, mid-50s. And the one takeaway from that, you know, that's 30 years ago now, 25 years ago, was, you know, life can be short. So get out there and do the things that you want to do when you want to do them. You've got to have the time, you've got to have some finance behind you, you've got to have the motivation and the stickability and the technical wanna get in there to complete a project like this. And if any of those things aren't there, it'll fall over. So there's probably only a window of opportunity in your life when you can actually commit to a thing like this and make it happen. So, you know, I really want to move from being an engineering builder dude to you know, really enjoying the driving side of it and getting, you know, getting some miles under the belt and find out how this thing that I've built actually goes. That's gonna be wonderful.
Very exciting. Have we missed anything? Is there anything that you know, I feel like we've covered
Oh,
the
mate, I can talk
car?
for hours. I can
Yeah.
talk for hours.
And I'd love
Do you
to,
want to?
but
You want
yeah,
to talk about piston coatings or ignition curves or, you know, fuel atomization or, you know,
I tell you
those,
what,
the
so there is another. I, you know what, this is turning into one of those. I mean, there's been a handful of these. Ironically, last week, one of these conversations that was supposed to be kind of 25, 30 minutes ended up being an hour and a half, you know, and we could have continued going. And in fact, the chap's going to come over to the UK in the not too distant future, and we're going to catch up and do some drives together. You
cool.
bond really quickly over these sorts of things. And I would love to have you back on, both from a heritage perspective to talk about the history of Porsche, but also when we get to the tech talks about engine building. We've got a company called Wrightune in the UK, and they're going to be supporting my build on the REM 550. So
Cool.
when we get to that stage, yeah, let's do a proper session on. You can talk me through everything you know on piston coatings and, you know, everything else. Yeah, be good.
Very, very, very happy to. Very happy to share what I've learned through this journey. Yeah, love to anytime.
Is there anything else important to the build that we might have missed, or do you think we've covered it? Or where are we?
No. I just think you know, in terms of an approach to a project like this, you know, don't underestimate how long and not necessarily difficult, but how involving it is. But if you really enjoy this type of thing, it's absolutely doable. But it's got to be your bag. You have to want to be happiest with a screwdriver in your hand. Yeah. You know, I drive a desk by day. So this is kind of a bit of a release, something that I don't have to do for a job. It's a hobby, but I love doing it. And if you can say that, then you're probably a good candidate to go for it. Not for everybody, for sure, but I've really thoroughly enjoyed the project to date. And it's yesterday was the conclusion of a very long journey getting it finally registered and on the road. Had to go through the whole compliance thing here, which is not for the faint-hearted as well. That itself was a whole quite a difficult process. But anyway, we're there, so. Yeah, draw a line under that and just get on with a couple
of things. Start using the car. Yeah. Well, listen, I've really, really, really enjoyed talking to you, and I'm very grateful for your time. And it's been a fascinating conversation to learn. You know, it's been one of those conversations that's been as much about the emotion behind the actual process of building it as it has the sort of technicality and the color, you know, the simple things like choosing a color, you know. But hearing about you spending time with your boy and, you know, what the future plans are. And yeah, it's been a lovely conversation. And, you know, big thanks from me to you to say, you know, welcome to the channel. Welcome to the alum that will be, you know, the guests that have appeared on the channel so far. And yeah, welcome back anytime.
Keep up the good work. Love being part of it.
Brilliant. Lovely. Thanks ever so much. And yeah, anytime we'll catch you again.
Sounds great, Paul. Nice one.
Take care.
Bye for now. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, if you're listening to this still on Spotify or any podcast streaming service, thank you so much for staying with it. I hope you really enjoyed the episode. Ross is such a nice guy, and you can obviously tell how passionate he was about working with his son, and then, you know, even across shipping things from the States over to New Zealand. I mean, all of it. It couldn't have been an inexpensive project, but you know, his passion comes across straight away. Please do head over to YouTube and subscribe over there at Rengineering on YouTube, at Rengineering UK on Instagram. TikTok, yes. Threads, yes. You know, wherever you find us, it will be at Rengineering other than Instagram, which is at Rengineering UK. For now, though, thank you so much. Hope you're all having a lovely week, and I've got a nice weekend planned as well. And I will see you next time. Take care for now. Bye-bye.